You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is I'm Ready for My Close-Up. Continuing our first anniversary month, tonight's show marks two special events. It's been almost exactly a year, 364 days if you want to split hairs, since I first hosted this show, and more importantly, it's been 30 years since the first issue of the venerable British comic 2000 AD first hit the stands. Tonight, in the first of two shows to celebrate the comic's history, myself and Duncan Knott are talking to Pat Mills, the original editor, or Mighty Tharg, if you prefer, of 2000 AD about the founding of the comic, the comic strips he's written, and the continuing success and relevance of the publication. Well, you were the original editor of 2000 AD, there's a story on the internet, I don't know how apocryphal it is, that the initial idea was pitched to you a couple of years earlier when you were editor of Action by a T-boy or something. And then with the success of films like Star Wars, you thought that there would be a gap in the market and sort of curated the comic.
Well, it's something like that. Basically, I would put it in slightly different terms as follows. I co-created Battle, I created Action, and then I went on to create 2000 AD. So it was a chain, and that was my job, basically, was to create New Boys comics and then move on to the next one.
Hmm.
So in the process of that, someone called Kelvin Gosnell came to me and said, there's a film coming up called Star Wars, and therefore science fiction would be a good bet for your next project. And, you know, I think gave 2000 AD very much my own sort of personal spin. And in fact, whilst you might think that films like Star Wars would have benefited 2000 AD, in fact, the opposite was the case. We came out from memory, I think, a little bit ahead of Star Wars, and I think our sales actually dipped during the Star Wars era. And then they picked up again afterwards, primarily because we were trying to get our own identity, our own style, which owes not a great deal to any other science fiction films or comics.
Hmm. Certainly if you look at something like Star Wars, George Lucas and Spielberg are very much influenced by 1930 serials, while 2000 AD obviously comes from a more sort of a darker British tradition that in a way kind of continues the kind of comics you were doing in Action and Battle.
That's exactly the case. In fact, on one level, 2000 AD was almost a retreat because I'd been so badly mauled on Action that it was like, well, okay, let's go into science fiction. We can say they're all robots, mutants, and it's all in the future, so it doesn't actually matter. And that's what we did. In fact, in the case of Judge Dredd, the publisher said to me, look, we're going to have problems with this with a board of directors. Can we set it? He'd obviously just been to see Star Wars. Can we set it in a galaxy far, far away? And I said, no way. It has to be New York, albeit New York of the future. So science fiction, in many ways, has been a retreat from some of the dark and grim reality, which, I have to be honest, is my first love.
You mentioned it was perhaps stepping back a bit. Is that maybe one of the keys to its success over the years, staying just on the right side of what people think is safe, but nudging that envelope all the time?
I think it's meant that it hasn't got into the same kind of trouble as Action. I think that there are many other things which have contributed to its success. Primarily, 2000 AD was building on the things that worked in Action and the things that worked in Battle. I think particularly in the course of Action, I suddenly saw for the first time what I would call a European potential that had not been present in British boys' comics until then, namely very large images, very classy-looking artwork, an emphasis on style rather than storytelling alone. And so, if you like, I learned a variety of things on Action and then applied them to 2000 AD.
There seems to be a fair amount of nostalgia as well with 2000 AD these days, that the comics, the strips that you created right at the beginning, things like Judge Dredd and Flesh and Schlone even, they're still in the comic today.
Yeah, I think what 2000 AD does today, and rightly so, is to strike a balance between what could be described as classic strips and new strips. I mean, it's pretty difficult to keep everybody happy all the time, but I think they do pretty well in as much as, you know, they will have some classic strips and some new strips. And I mean, and that is a hard thing to put together, because if you think, for example, of Marvel, supposing Marvel Comics came out tomorrow with a great new superhero, it could be absolutely brilliant, but it's got to compete with Spider-Man, X-Men, and so forth. So it's a very, very hard thing for them to follow. And in the same way with 2000 AD, if someone comes up with a new story, they've got all those tried and tested classics that they're up against. And bear in mind, the ones that are shown today, stories like Savage, which is from the original Invasion, ABC Warriors, and so forth, these are the tried and tested ones that have worked. The others that have not worked so well have disappeared. Another thing I should say, actually, my objective originally on 2000 AD, which I was to some extent thwarted on, was not to have a lead story. It was very, very determined to prevent that happening. In other words, what I wanted was six or seven stories, and they were all lead stories. Every single one I saw as having the potential to be number one, rather than, you know, Judge Dredd and a bunch of also-rans. And to a large extent, that did actually happen. Many of the stories at the very beginning of 2000 AD, I think they all took a turn at being number one, with perhaps one exception. So, for instance, the lead story in 2000 AD for the first 11 weeks of its life, I think, was Mac One, which was a $6 million man character. It was only as the readers got into the complex world of Dredd, and as the original writer took over again, namely John Wagner, that it really took off with the readers. But it was very much my aim to have an all-star comic, which could potentially and hopefully spin off into different subsequent comics, although that never actually happened.
Well, in fact, the opposite happened. You ended up folding comics like Star-Lord into 2000 AD.
That's correct, and that policy is one that I've always abhorred. It was known as hatch, match, and dispatch. And it's a dreadful idea. And basically, it's conning the readers and conning the newsagents, because you have two publications. One's going down the tubes. You combine their circulations. The print orders go up. And meanwhile, the readers suddenly pick up their comic and discover that there's these news stories in there that they don't know anything about and don't want. It's an ugly policy that I think made commercial sense for some years, but I think it was already out of date by the time I came along. And I remember saying to the board of directors when they interviewed me once for a job, and they said, well, what were the changes that you would make? And I said, well, the first thing I would do is get rid of hatch, match, and dispatch, and then listed similar sort of things that I would do, which was not to their liking. So I remain freelance.
There's almost an element that that's happened in a slightly better way since, because if you, I guess, reading 2018 now, it's not too hard to see hints of comics gone by, like Crisis or, to a certain extent, Deadline, things like that, where the influence over the years has filtered in as the originals, you know, left by the wayside, and perhaps it feels a bit more satisfying and a bit more evolved and like it's meant to be there.
I think when it, what should we say, when it's a cousin, like Crises was, which was very closely linked to 2000 AD, I think that's reasonable. I think there have been times in the past where it was overly influenced by the music press, or even, God help us, Loaded. And I can't say that I personally think a great deal of that. I think 2000 AD has far too much of its own identity to need to, you know, have this kind of sub-music look about it. And I think a while back, it also, for a while, had a kind of vaguely, it was kind of influenced or looking towards American comics like Vertigo. Now, you see, I personally think that we have such a strong identity of our own that we don't need to be a nursery ski slope for Vertigo or for any other American comic, or a springboard to them. We are who we are, and we've arrived. In other words, in that sense, there is nowhere for 2000 AD to go other than to be stronger, better, attract stronger artists, attract more readers, and so forth. I think it's a mistake to look too far over our shoulder at other publications. It would be like Private Eye, for example, trying to be like the late lamented Punch. It would be silly. You know, you have to be who you are. And I think the success of 2000 AD over these 30 years is primarily because everyone concerned believes in themselves. And just occasionally when that wavers, which has happened in the past, I don't think that's actually a very good thing.
What you're saying about it being a nursery slope, in a way that must be both a help and a hindrance to the comic, that a lot of writers and artists must come to 2000 AD sort of to hone their talents and then get attracted by the bright light of America. I mean, in as much as the British film industry is like that at times.
I think that's true. Actually, the lights aren't so bright. They're actually fairly dim unless somebody manages to end up writing or drawing X-Men. For the majority of people, it may sort of sharpen their egos in the fan press, but the reality, the dollar is pretty crap. They have a lot more creative freedom in the British market. I mean, I suppose to a certain extent I do that myself, but I do it in a different direction. I work, apart from for 2000 AD, I work primarily for France. And I don't know how far you're aware, but the European comics were a key influence on 2000 AD. In a certain sense, it's almost a French comic, because all the ground rules that were established in the first 6 months of 2000 AD were primarily based on French publications like Maître Hurlant. So, yeah, I suppose in a certain sense, I've kind of springboarded to France. And I think my situation is perhaps different to many other contributors, in as much as having started it, I don't think I can really get away from it. But yeah, I can understand that for others, they would see it as a springboard, and perhaps economic necessity requires them to do that. I think there is a lot of satisfaction in working for it as an end objective. In other words, hey, it would be great to do something for 2000 AD, the only British comic in the adventure market, at least, that's been around this long.
A couple of British films over the years had spin-off strips in 2000 AD. There was Shaun of the Dead and that Danny Boyle film. I can't think of the name.
Yeah, I know the one you mean, I think, yeah.
So there is obviously an attraction for within British culture.
Affection. I think a lot of... There has been talk from time to time. I think a couple of documentary filmmakers have talked about doing a documentary on 2000 AD from the point of view of all the 30-somethings who are now in strong positions in the media and who obviously were very influenced by 2000, you know, when they were kids. Which is very gratifying to know that that's happened. And, yeah, I mean, it's nice to have that subtext to the comic, to know that it is, in a certain sense, and not in a boring sense, an institution.
There's the range of people in, as you say, positions of power, and you were mentioning earlier that 2000 AD developed a very distinctive voice from the word go.
Sure.
Given that you drove an awful lot of that, it sounds as if some of that was quite anti-establishment.
Totally. Totally. I have no choice in the matter. Whatever muse drives me is unfortunately of an anti-establishment persuasion, yeah.
Is it good to see it flourishing in the wider world?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I do meet all sorts of people in different walks of life who, what should we say, quite anti-establishment characters who do claim that they were highly influenced by 2000 AD for whatever they're up to, hopefully legal, not always entirely. And, yeah, I mean, that's not bad. It's good. I think the thing is, and this, I think, is often perhaps not appreciated today, is that the core of British comics, in my view, always was, what should we say, kind of anti-establishment, kind of subversive, because that at the heart of it is what should we say, cutting-edge British culture. You know, whether it's Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, Ken Loach, Mike Leigh, Monty Python, these are the kind of things that I grew up on, and even before that, British comics were going down that road. Let me give you an example or two. You have the Bash Street Kids. Now, I can remember as a kid being aware of how wildly subversive that was. Its creator, Leo Baxendale, told me once how one of the very first Bash Street Kids stories was one where the kids steal an army tank from an army camp and attack a police station with it, obviously in a very cartoony way. But, I mean, you clearly couldn't do that today in these politically correct and, you know, sort of awful times we live in. But, I mean, you know, I can remember reading that as a kid, and this kind of story, and thinking, wow. And there were similar stories, other stories from the Pino. So the flavour of comics for me, and I think for many people, has always been this very British form of subversion, of satire, of taking a bit of a swipe at the establishment. And I think this, of course, is why traditional teachers used to loathe and tear up comics. I mean, you'd almost know you were doing it right if they tore it up. They certainly used to tear up Action, which I can't tell you how much glee that would give me when I would hear that, you know?
Talking of the wider influence of 2000 AD on culture, there's obvious things like the Judge Dredd movie, but I was watching an episode of Doctor Who Confidential last year, and they were talking about the episode where there's a CGI Satan in a pit, in the Satan pit, and they were saying a big influence on that was Simon Bisley's art for Schlon, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Simon's, you know, Celtic hero interpretation was fantastic. I mean, that was a big, big jump forward, I think, for us, because there we were having Frank Frazetta artwork of an incredibly high standard in a British comic selling at that time for about £1. So that was tremendous. And I think there have been a lot of examples of that. I mean, even Braveheart, it seemed to me, looked like it had taken a look at the Horned God, for example.
Mm. The choice of doing strips that are set in the past, I mean, right from nearly the beginning, you had stories of Shalko, the polar bear, and things like that. Presumably, those environments are as alien to readers as the far future, so it just about slipped within the remit.
Yeah. I mean, Shalko and all those early stories were... I think sometimes science fiction doesn't have to be set in a galaxy far, far away, and I think that was certainly one of the premises of 2000 AD, that there should be identifiable fantasy, dinosaurs on Earth, this polar bear being pursued by the CIA, that kind of fantasy. Funnily enough, to make a spaceship story work in comics is incredibly difficult. Very, very few stories are popular. I mean, at least within the remit of 2000 AD, stories like Star Trek, maybe there is a Star Trek comic, I don't know, and maybe it's popular, but generally speaking, spaceship stories are very difficult to make work.
Hmm. Which were the ones that you found, if not easiest, the most sort of satisfying to write over
For
the
me.
Years? Yeah.
Oh, that's difficult. I think all the stories that I personally write are satisfying, because obviously otherwise I wouldn't do them.
Mm.
You have to have that personal satisfaction, because these aren't stories that you're writing, you know, to dig your swimming pool with. You know, you're not going to make a vast amount of money on this, so you have to enjoy them. There has to be personal pleasure in writing them. I suppose currently one of them would be Savage, a story about thinly disguised, it's more a fascist invasion of Britain rather than a Russian invasion. I think that would be more accurate. And I find that very satisfying, because it's a story about what it is like to be invaded by another country.
Mm.
Now, to have a foreign army walking down your high street, whether it happens to be in Baghdad or London, is a very offensive feeling. And I've done a fair bit of travelling, and I've come across this here and there, and you can really feel it in the air when somebody has, you know, another country walking down the high street. So Savage is very much a reflection of that. And so there's a lot of satisfaction for me personally.
Thinking about that and thinking back to things you've done before, like Third World War, it seems that, you know, almost as the world turns from bad to worse, stories get better and better. They're asked, you know, what are you working on next, and what should we be worried about next?
what am I working on next? I suppose to a certain extent, I'm kind of retreating a little bit into fantasy, in as much as I'm writing a steampunk story set in the 17th century, featuring Sir Isaac Newton and Robert Hooke and various other scientists. So that seems fairly harmless, although it's obviously got its own unique spin. The other story I'm writing, I suppose, does have more of a political subtext. It's called Grey Suit, which is the name used, certainly within the criminal underworld and probably elsewhere, for the British Men in Black. In other words, in Britain we don't have Men in Black. They're called Grey Suits, which I think you'll agree is a uniquely British way of describing dodgy, subversive people who do dodgy, subversive things. So one story is, that's one of the stories that I'm writing currently, about a British secret agent who is a programmed assassin. And it does reflect some stories that make the news and one or two that don't make the news.
Do you think it is that element of trying to reflect current events and using a healthy pinch of satire that's kept the comic going for 30 years when other British comics have been and gone?
I think it's one of the factors that have done it. I think particularly, I think, in Judge Dredd, with some of John Wagner's writing there and some of Mike McMahon's artwork, Brian Bullen's artwork, I mean, some of the wonderfully subversive piss takes on various TV shows, various people like Michael Jackson. I think they've all turned up in Judge Dredd in one form or another. It's been one of the things, but it is only one of them. Because, I mean, this is the thing with 2000, its strength and its weakness is this, that there's approximately five or six stories in the comic, and so there's something there for everyone, but there's also something in there for everyone to hate as well, to say, my God, why have they brought that back? Why don't they get rid of him? It's a little bit like expecting a modern audience to sit down and watch every program between 7 in the evening and 11 in the evening. They're not going to do that. They're going to channel hop. So I think one of the strengths of 2000 is that, you know, we have something to appeal to everyone, but it also, of course, from time to time, if you have one of those stories that the readers really hate, my God, will you know about it? They will really roast whoever is responsible. I think one that springs to mind, not one of mine I hastily had, is called, I think, Space Girls, which was some kind of, I think it was a satire on Spice Girls. But the readers loathed it, and I think, yeah, I think they got quite abusive on the subject.
Well, I'm sure we've probably all got our own favourites and pet hates. I mean, I don't remember particularly disliking Space Girls, but for the life of me, I can't understand why Nicolai Dante keeps on coming back. So, you know, each to his own.
Well, I like that one.
That's it, you see. There is this... It is unusual, I think. I mean, when 2000 AD first came out, there was nothing unusual about an anthology. But in the times we live in, it is relatively unusual because people tend to like a lot of what they like. So if you happen to like Nicolai Dante, in an ideal world, you want a graphic novel full of Nicolai Dante or full of Savage or whatever it is. So you're almost sort of forced to put up with the others. But I think how we get over that is it's still a very reasonable price, and you know that if there's a particular story you don't happen to like, well, it's only occupying 12% of the publication, and 2 months' time, it will have gone away.
You mentioned some of the artists you've worked with in the past, having so much experience. Do you get a chance to say, right, I'm writing this story, and this is the person I'd like doing it? I mean, people like Simon Bisley over the years, and now Clint Langley.
I have to work closely with the artist, because if I just leave it to fate, which I have done in the past, I've often had no choice but to do that. Different editorial people in the past would, not allow me to make that choice. And if it doesn't work, by God, everybody gets it in the neck. The readers roast the artist, they roast the writer, they roast the editor. So for everybody's sanity, I have to know the artist I'm working with. I have to have some empathy with him. And I do work with new artists, but I kind of weigh them up very carefully and say, yeah, I can see that this guy would be good for my story and I'll be good for him and all the rest of it. You do have to weigh it up very closely. And obviously it does help if you have particular empathy with a specific artist. I mean, I have a great deal of empathy with Clint Langley on Slane and on ABC Warriors, because I think he's actually doing something quite new and quite exciting in terms of he's doing the comic equivalent of CGI, And I think increasingly readers are taking on board that he's actually doing something very, very potent and exciting. And it's not a shortcut. It's not, oh, well, this is a quick way to make money. It's actually the reverse. I think Clint probably takes at least as long as traditional artwork by using computer techniques. But it does open up some great possibilities in terms of being able to, you know, create fantastic backgrounds, but without taking 3 weeks to draw them, you know?
Yeah, it's almost hard to tell looking at some of the new ABC Warriors stuff. You think, well, how did that happen without his eyes popping out of his head? But
yeah, I think it has a lot of excitement to it because, I mean, people accept in movies that you can have computer-generated backgrounds and you can have things dubbed in and that the actor hero doesn't have to literally, you know, do all his own stunts and swing through the air and all the rest of it, that it can be done with, you know, in a computer-generated way. So Clint is doing the comic book equivalent of that. To the best of my knowledge, he's out there on his own there. And, again, it's a matter of great inner belief that he really believes in what he's doing and is very passionate about it. And I think that particularly comes through on ABC Warriors, where when you look at the pages of it, for me at least, it's like going to the movies. There's never going to be an ABC Warrior movie because it'd be too expensive. I mean, it cost a fortune. But when you see these robots clanking around on the page, it's pretty darn close to a film, you know.
For 2000 AD is around for another 30 years. What do you think it'll be like in the year 2037?
Well, I suppose I should probably come out with some incredible bullshit answer there, but let me think of what the reality would be like. Well, 30 years' time.
I mean, do you think it'll be download only by then, or...?
Well, in terms of the technicalities of it, I suppose it probably has to. But I think, you know, there has been a lot of resistance to comics on the web. I mean, I've been marginally involved with them over the years, my impression has been that people do want paper. Now, I can't see why, even with sophisticated advances, that people should still not want some form of paper in 30 years' time. I might be sounding incredibly Luddite now, but, there hasn't been a revolution in that direction thus far. People do obviously like to look at things on the web and all the rest of it, but to my knowledge, I think it's the smell of a comic, it's the feel of it, and so forth. In terms of whether 2000 AD will still be around in 30 years' time, I think it probably will, because it has got very firm foundations, and so many people are into it, that if something awful happened to it, you know, in the near future, probably somebody would revive it, bring it back, and, you know, it is an institution in that sense. Just as, for example, Doctor Who has been around from the year dot, and I'm sure Doctor Who will be around in 30 years' time. I'm sure in some form or another, you know, things like Star Trek will be. Why not 2000 AD?
To continue our look at 30 years of 2000 AD, next week, Duncan and I will be talking to Matt Smith, the current editor of the comic, about his tenure at the reins and what we have to look forward to in future issues of the periodical. If you enjoyed tonight's show and would like to hear more programmes about comics, TV and film, not to mention the wide output that Resonance broadcasts throughout the week, please visit www.resonancefm.com and either become a friend of the station or donate some money to help save this anarchic, futuristic British institution. If you'd like to discuss tonight's show or download the podcast, please visit www.readyformyclosesup.blogspot.com, and I'm Ready for My Close-Up. We'll be back at the same time next week.